Maybe to begin, we'll have each of us introduce ourselves and what we do and maybe why and all of that fun stuff. So, Rob, you know,
Robert Wojcik, a sporadically published writer. I teach.
Can you say, oh, okay, it's double sided.
yes, on both sides. I guess it's more worried I'd forget.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
What was that? I teach computer science, and occasionally I teach a science fiction course, so probably three times in the last 10 years. And I've taken a couple of science fiction courses, so that's why I'm qualified if there's such thing for this path.
Okay, Greg?
My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University in New York City, and I've actually been teaching courses in fantasy and science fiction since I got there, so 2002 or 3. I also teach a course in creative writing, and I'm a writer. My first novel was published last year, I'm also co-editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics, and so I guess I've been trying to see this from a lot of different angles, I guess, in the process of my teaching my kids at my university. So,
I'm Mike Johnson. I'm currently teaching at University of Toronto, downtown St. George campus. And I've been teaching, science fiction and the fantasy and horror courses for about the last 3.5-4 years straight. When I was at Astor last year, I went to a lot of sessions and panels and saw that there were a lot of people who not only write but also teach, whether in college or grade school or university and stuff. So I thought, for my own interest, it'd be really interesting to have a panel kind of on this theme. I can't claim yet to be a published author one of these days. So my reason for being here is that I teach this and that I know some of the organizers. I guess for me, one of the main reasons I proposed on the panel was that in teaching science fiction and fantasy over the last few years, you get kind of more immersed in not just the literature but the community and so on. And that you see that there's been this kind of long-standing tension, let's call it, between say sort of the academic study of or the teaching of science fiction and fantasy. And those in the community being writers, editors, fans, and so on, who distrust or dislike or even dismiss the kind of study and scholarship on it and teaching of science fiction and fantasy. And for me, I was, I'm kind of looking for ways to maybe have a bit more of a kind of dialogue about this. I thought as a beginning, I would read something. you guys know Neil Asher, British science fiction writer?
Yeah.
So on his blog back in, I think, September, this is what he wrote. It was, I don't know if you guys know, back in September or back in December, there was another one of these sort of the death of science fiction brouhahas, I suppose. And this was part of his response. He wrote, "I do get heartily sick of all this effort to stick head up own backside to examine one's navel from the inside. I started reading SFF over 30 years ago, but it wasn't until I got involved with the small presses, started finding out about organizations like the BSFA and the BFS, and started reading various magazines that I discovered that SF seems to have a parasite literature attached to it. Whole swaths of self-styled academics pontificate about the meaning of it all. They wank off into deep critical analysis of stories and books. My first close encounter with this was discovering a review of Mason's Rats that was about twice the length of the story itself, have lengthy discussions about issues in SF, and speak with all seriousness about gender divides and genre, the lack of representation of homosexuals, the implicit racism in something like Starship Troopers. Really, if you can be bothered to read all through these highly intelligent waffles, the only response upon finishing the last line is to point and giggle." Yes. It was interesting for me because this was a very recent sort of comment and seemed to be very kind of indicative of a certain sort of attitude toward the academic study or the teaching of or the scholarship on science fiction and fantasy. So that is a kind of, you know, beginning, I suppose. We can talk about Asher's position, I guess, later on. So I thought I would start off with a question that perhaps we can all address. So what have you found to be the most rewarding and or surprising in your teaching of science fiction and fantasy. And what's most rewarding about teaching the genre? What have you found most surprising in teaching in the genre?
Well, in teaching, I have to reread and relearn the stories. And so the personally for me, the re-examining familiar stories to see that they're richer than I first assumed they were. Sort of hidden depths revealed to me, I suppose, is the...
What about with your students?
I'm teaching at a community college level, so there isn't such a great divide, right? So I don't really see a lot of... we teach genre courses, so we have science fiction, horror, detective fiction, and the students don't really care about the divide that you were alluding to, and the faculty don't really care about it either, so it's not really an issue. Typically in a class, there'd be five or six hardcore SF fans, and the rest are taking it because they consider it probably an easy literature elective. So it's a different world, I think, than you two are in.
No, I'm season seven.
I mean, I would say, I would agree that there's some similarities there. I mean, I have right now 23 and are taking my class right now. Of those, probably about maybe six or seven might be sort of hardcore, you know, watch every episode of Doctor Who, tell me about why am I not teaching the latest episode of it. and then the other students tend to be sort of broadly interested in the subject. I don't think I have too many people teaching because now I've been there for a while, so I have a reputation of not being an easy A, so I think I've managed to winnow those people away. But I think most of them just find it a generally intriguing topic. And so, you know, I agree entirely that this thing about the divide, I think that's typical understated Asher, right? But I think it really doesn't matter except to a very limited group of people. Yeah. And I think that they would have no concept that there was some big split, you know, about what we should or shouldn't do with fantasy. I think the most surprising thing I find is that some of the books that I've taught that I don't find myself, I teach wondering how they're going to react to it. And I teach it because it's very important within the genre, because I'm really teaching an introduction to fantasy and science fiction. But, you know, maybe I wouldn't think that it's, like, on the level of sort of these other books that I'm conscious of. And I'll often be struck about how much the students just fall in love with a particular book over and over again, and that requires me to go back in and sort of take another look at the book. The classic example for me is Ender's Game, which is what I'm going to be teaching next week. And I am lukewarm about Ender's Game, actually. My students are never lukewarm about Ender's Game. They love Ender's Game. Please, can we have more Ender's Game every year? The other books, you know, that I teach A Wizard of Earthsea, for example, that is hot and cold. Sometimes students like that a little bit more than others. And then I also obviously add and remove certain books over the course of the years. But those are two that I generally teach. Wizard of Earthsea is all over the place. But Ender's Game, they always love it. And what that required me to do was to go back and see what it was that they were connecting to, that I maybe as a writer on one level and then as an academic on another maybe wasn't getting. And so that was one of the best parts of this for me, is it's given me an opportunity to, you know, read more carefully into my own assumptions and predispositions, right, about the field, and to get a better sense of what, you know, students will be seeing that I won't be seeing. It doesn't mean that it will ever become my favorite book, but I have grown to appreciate it much more, I think, than I did at the beginning, where I thought, let me try something which is an important seminal work, but I'm not sure about this, and they just went to town on it every time. So
I had a discussion with the head of the English department about we only do one novel and a number of short stories.
Okay.
But I've been using Ender's Game because it works very well with the students. And I had to convince the head of the department. He was pushing Le Guin on me.
Mm.
And he'd never read Ender's Game. And he'd read a lot of science fiction, but he hadn't. But he was pushing for the kind of novels that that I saw when I was taking university courses.
Yep.
So, you know, a little more serious, a little more highbrow, heightened language compared to Ender's Game.
I think for me, one of the most rewarding things is actually having to read older stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back to, you know, writers like Campbell and Asimov,
sure,
and C.L. Moore and Paget and a lot of that stuff from the 30s and 40s and 50s that, for me, certainly is a long-time science fiction fan I never read. And in the course that I do, I try to give them at least a good historical kind of sense of science fiction, really,
yeah,
since the late 19th century,
mm-hmm,
you know, up to pretty recently. And so, for me, reading the older stuff, and finding a lot of really interesting, valuable things to talk about with them, and then connecting them to later works, and you can really see how a genre evolves. And it's great to see students who come up to me and say, "Man, I've never heard of Daniel Keyes. It's like, that's the best thing I've ever read." You know, Flowers for Algernon becomes a,
yeah,
you know, like a an epiphany for them,
yep,
you know, and stuff like that.
Yep.
And so that's been really rewarding for me. And I think one of the surprising things has been that, so the course I've been teaching at U of T, this year grew to 220.
Wow.
So, and it's students from all over campus. So it's every faculty, every department.
You, wow,
get. So you get engineers and, you know, scientist students and sociology students, English students from all over the place. And I will, each time I teach the course, I will get at least between 5 to 10 students who come up to me and said, "You know, I never read science fiction before. I didn't know anything about it. And, you know, now, there's some stuff I want to read." And so I have that opportunity of introducing people to something that they've never actually,
yeah, that's great,
experienced. And that's really rewarding, too, and,
yeah,
and stuff. But I find in terms of some of the things that are, like you were saying, that some of the things you connect with the students don't,
mm-hmm,
and so on. And I found that, for instance, last term I did Ian MacDonald's River of Gods. I loved it,
yeah,
right? But students were like, "It's too long." it's a little bit over 500 pages, you know. So the ways in which they react, I'm thinking, "My God, come on! It's like this future cyberpunk, you know, stuff in India. It's odd. It's, you know, politics. It's too long." And things like, and you get these, and I thought they'd be wowed by this, you know, cyberpunk novel set in the future India, and they just, it just felt flat.
Yeah, you know? I had a similar. I taught James Patrick Kelly's Burn last year, and I know Jim pretty well, and it just didn't work. I think part of the reason maybe that it came after Ender's Game, which was the big towering apex of everything for them, and then they read this and they were like, "Well, yeah." And they were polite, but they were just not into it. And I've sort of cast about to find something to fit into that final slot, and I, you know, because I'm trying to sort of incorporate a lot of the sort of, as you say, kind of give them a historical sweep if I can.
Yeah.
Of both science fiction and fantasy, though, because we only have the one combined course at the moment. I'm trying to change that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and so there was an example of something that I thought was great, and it had all this interesting stuff about, and there was environmental things, which, you know, is not something that we had talked a lot about,
yeah,
up to that point,
mm-hmm,
and they just were kind of like, "I don't, what?" You know, it was, and I guess it was a little maybe too much to throw at a class which basically wasn't coming at science fiction and fantasy with a broad knowledge in it. And so, yeah, I've had the exact same experience before, too.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways what becomes the most rewarding thing for me in teaching the genre is opening students' eyes to stuff they might never have read or authors they might never have heard of. I mean, you'll even get, you know, the hardcore science fiction folks and you'll throw someone at them that they've never read.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a guy say, "Who's this Elizabeth Baer? I've never read her. She's incredible. I told all my friends about her." I'm like, "Oh."
Yep.
There you go. There's a lot of your stuff's online, you know, and that's really rewarding too, when you can have something that you found and then you open people's, I guess, eyes and ears to not just a genre, but particular writers and genres and subgenres within science fiction.
Especially when they're familiar with it in other mediums. So I teach,
yeah,
I teach Beowulf, and then I pair that with Grendel, which is one of my favorite books, and I think even now is underappreciated. And
mm-hmm,
and they, you know, they've heard of Beowulf, and some of them have read Beowulf, and of course they know the movie Beowulf.
Right.
And then I have a joke that, like, every book that I teach in my course has had some hideous movie made about it, you know, with, and it's, you know, like, I teach iRobot also, and what a disaster, you know, so they all go out, you know, and then I get these emails from people, "You were right, it's nothing like the book, and I can't believe it," you know, like, good, go forth, and spread the word.
I'm teaching I Am Legend in May, so.
Oh, are you? Okay, see, so, but I've gotten totally off my track. So I think that it's interesting to watch my students sort of come to grips with authors that they would not have understood anything about before and wouldn't have encountered likely before, and find that that then sends them off in directions that I might not have anticipated.
Yeah.
And, you know, so a lot of my students love Gardner's Grendel because it's a great book, and it allows them then to understand different interpretations of Beowulf when they come across them, and they will come across many in a different way than they might have before, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Have you had similar experiences?
As I mentioned, we do a number of short stories and one novel, and it's probably the same. It's a survey course. We don't do fantasy; it's just strictly science fiction. There is a separate fantasy course. So I'm, basically feeding them classic SF short stories, and I find that it really seems to pique their interest when we hit Flowers for Algernon.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, almost every student I've ever had.
Sure.
And all of the classic stuff is kind of a hard sell, and I have to work hard to make them appreciate the stories. But once you hit Flowers for Algernon, and there are a few others that they like. Name escapes me at the moment. It's a Good Life. But we're getting into softer science, and the early Asimov and those kind of guys, they just, a lot of the students are not really all that interested in the subject matter. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's true. It's they're looking for an elective to fill up their...
There are those practical things.
They're not English students. They're mostly technology students.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they're averse to reading, which is a big problem.
Well, hard SF is definitely a hard sell. I tried that same slot that I keep struggling with. I tried... Stanislaw Lem, I tried Tales of Perks, the pilot. Again, no. I mean, because it's too much. It's too much from their point of view, number crunching. And a lot of my kids actually are either their journalism majors or English majors, floating around, some kind of language or literature-oriented field. And for them, they can't deal with that. And so I had to go with something, I keep trying for something a little bit softer, or a little bit, that'll maybe sort of be more their speed. So for me, it's kind of a little bit of the opposite problem in that there's some aspects of the genres or subgenres that I can't really or have not yet been able to sort of fit in a way that will work for them. So.
I've been doing Peter Watts' Blindsight for the last couple of terms.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's been a huge hit.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's been a huge
hit. No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, almost every story. Like this again, and I do it. It's the final text in the course.
Oh wow.
So they've gone, from like Asimov and Campbell all the way up through, and then we finish with Peter Watts and hard science fiction. And, kind of the new space opera and stuff, and they love it because it's also a beautifully written book. It's incredibly well written, but and I've had biology students and physiology students like, oh, I love this book, but also just.
So you're not teaching English majors.
I get all in this course. I get from all over the place. Yeah, I get science students, engineering. Like the engineering students love it.
I can see that. Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that. I guess that's just. I don't know that my not sure my liberal arts kids would be into it as much.
But there's also a lot in there about narrative.
And, sure, of course.
Of course. Reliability, fallibility, and
definitely.
All those kinds of things. Yeah. Let's see. I'll ask another question, then we can open it up to comments and stuff. In what ways is the academic teaching, or let's say post, what would we call it? Post-secondary teaching. In what ways is the academic teaching of science fiction and fantasy a positive for the genre? And are there ways in which it might be even detrimental to the genre?
Well, again, I'm not teaching to quite the same crowd, so I don't really see that as a legitimate question or a valid question for what I'm doing.
Okay.
But, the answer is I'm introducing a lot of students to something new. And and some of them actually become very enthusiastic. And that's one of the reasons I like Ender's Game is because I've heard I know a number of students have gone out and bought the sequel.
Right.
And that hasn't happened with anything else.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, for the detrimental part, I guess you can see, Neil's screed. I think that, I don't know if we do this as academics, and maybe people here will want to comment about it, I don't know. But I feel like we as academics have a tendency to I don't know, assume that our battles matter. I don't really think that anybody is sitting out there thinking, you know, God, what does Samuel Delaney think about my book? You know, like, I don't, or David Hartwell or something, you know, I don't, yeah. So someone who's got, you know, more academic cred. I have never gotten, you know, one bit of grief from a faculty member at all for teaching a course in science fiction fantasy. They love that I do it. They love that I write it. My students love that I write it and can teach them in it. They think it's very cool because it all sort of connects together, and they, and I find that I take it very seriously. I do teach it it is a serious course. It is not lighthearted stuff. We obviously have a lot of laughs in the teaching of it, as good teaching does, I think. But the overall purpose of it is deadly serious, and it's that this literature has something important to tell. To the extent that academic work, I think, can sort of solidify the notion of fantasy and science fiction as a critically important genre, which I think everybody here is going to agree that it is, to the extent that academia can sort of solidify that, it's all to the good. When academia becomes too... I mean, the problem with the blog entry is that all academics do is navel-gaze. Like, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's fantasy or science fiction or whatever else. Like, I mean, read any, like, post-New Criticism in the last 30 years, and you'll see a lot of, you know, looking at one's navel, right? Like, so I think that academics, if they become too much like academics, can hurt a genre, because they can make people believe. Students can take it and think to themselves, what the hell? Why? This has nothing, this is not at all relevant to my experience. I think if academics are willing to get out of the way and let students know that there are serious academic discussions going on about this work, and to the extent that it may help and apply, you know, particular theories and concepts to the work, that's useful. But leave out the sort of the little minor turf wars that don't really matter. You know, just as I think we would leave out minor turf wars of our academic organizations outside of science fiction and fantasy. I think if we can do that as academics in this particular field too, then I think we can benefit them by giving it a kind of seriousness and credibility without getting them involved in this little kind of minor stuff. So yeah. Charting a middle course, I guess, is what I would say.
Yeah.
That's the best way to do it.
I mean, I guess an interesting, I guess, question for me along these lines is, once, certainly at least in Canada, once a major institution like U of T has a science fiction, or it used to be science fiction and fantasy, now it's been split, and the course has been around for, I think, at least a decade. But the teaching of science fiction and fantasy in, say, the post-secondary system didn't really start until the 70s, I think, right?
It might have been later than that.
And I think one question I try to raise, or at least I try to pose to my students, is, well, what is kind of signified by teaching this stuff in a university setting? And are we thus lending a certain kind of credibility and legitimacy to the genre by making it part of, you know, a course of university study?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways, I see that as, I think you're right in that... There is the potential for that to be detrimental, in the sense that, do we only legitimize it through an academic discourse, and that can become rather insular.
Yeah.
But I think the opportunity to treat science fiction and fantasy and horror, speculative fiction, maybe more broadly, as you said, as a critical literature that has something to say.
Yeah.
I think the academic university or college or even secondary context. Can be really, I think, positive in that respect. And I know for me, in terms of teaching the genre, I've come to see that as partly a little bit of a kind of responsibility I feel in teaching the course, in that, because on the one hand, you know, certainly part of the history of science fiction is that, you know, and fantasy, this stuff's for entertainment. And there are students who resist treating these works, whether it's Ender's Game or Lord of the Rings, or they resist treating it in, let's say, a kind of theoretical, critical, analytical manner. Like, this stuff's just entertainment. I like to raise that question with them. But one, I feel part of my responsibility is to show them that these texts can bear different kinds of approaches, can bear different kinds of readings, and that they are complicated and sophisticated enough for this kind of exercise. For instance, I think it was last year, I was doing Dan Simmons' Ilium. You know, it was Ilium Olympus.
Yeah, okay.
And so I was doing Ilium because, well, you know, he's got Shakespeare and you know, Proust and all that stuff in there, and it's wonderfully elusive and all these kinds of things. And one of my TAs did a lecture in which she raised, you know, very interesting questions that, you know, if Simmons, by taking on Homer and Proust and Shakespeare, is trying to, for instance, in a sense, kind of, you know, thrust science fiction into the Western canon and legitimize it in that way, it is science fiction, and Simmons, for instance, prepared to deal with questions like, well, is there a certain kind of... she raised the question of the ways in which Simmons is kind of rereading some of these texts from seemingly a kind of homophobic perspective. You know, and so do we want to talk about science fiction in these ways, and are these valuable approaches to those books and to the genre? And I think they are.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because for the precise reason that you just said. I mean, we let off reading, you know, Neil's piece, and you know, I find a lot of that his argument a cop out. I mean, essentially, so what he says is he wants this to be taken seriously, but not too seriously. And if we criticize it, you know, if you have a problem with the way something is represented with science fiction, well, come on, please, let's be honest here. It's all popcorn, folks, and you know, yeah, and that sort of thing. I mean, that's absurd. You know, if you're gonna ask for credibility, then exactly as you said, you better be willing to accept the same questions that have been issued to, you know, works on a much broader scale in all other genres. There's no reason that if science fiction and fantasy is mature enough to handle the scrutiny, and it absolutely is, that you shouldn't be willing to accept that there's going to be mature questions being asked. So, in that sense, I entirely agree, and I think it's a good way to put it. It had better be ready then for the questions that, you know, get asked of it, and not sort of try to play this double game of, you know, well, you should take us seriously, but, you know, if there's any problem, you know, please buy my book, and it's all, you know, fun and games anyway, and then, you know, and then yeah, they run out the door. Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about when you were talking was, and I don't know if you've had the same experience, Bob, maybe as well, that since our students have an incredible amount of exposure increasingly to popular culture, yeah, versions of science fiction and fantasy, right? I mean, these are kids who are coming out of a Harry Potter. I mean, you know, we're getting now the first group of kids, yeah, that started out with Sorcerer's Stone, right? So we got the first Harry Potter kids, yeah, are coming into our classrooms now. And so you have the Harry Potter kids, you have, God help us, Twilight. You have kids who are being exposed to superhero films at an incredible clip, you know, much more than certainly when we were growing up, or even, you know, even in the last, say, 10, 15 years, the last 5, 10 years, there's been this enormous explosion of X-Men films and Batman and, you know, all these reboots and refranchises.
Video games.
And video games, yeah, has been a big part of it, too, so that by the time they reach us, I think from an academic point of view, we had better be ready to teach them the things that they're already interested in. And if we do teach it to them, then we run the benefit. And I think this is, I don't know, I'd be interested to see whether you find the same thing. I find that my students are often, wow, like this is, I like these things, and you say it's all right for me to like them, you know, because they're used to being told, no, not that, you know, not that, only this, you know, boom, big marble statue of something. And so I think for us, it's, you know, it sort of represents an agility, I think, if you will, mm-hmm, that we're able to teach something, and they almost don't expect that we'd be ready for that sort of thing. Like, you know, oh, really? Well, I watched over, the, you know, I was looking at the, you know, pre-trailers to Thor, and I, really? You know? So I think that that's helpful for us to be able to demonstrate that we are connected in some ways to what they're doing, so that we're helping both ways. It is helping the genre because it is worthy of scrutiny. It is helping us because it shows that something they care about is something that we care about in an academic way. So I don't know if you found the same thing.
You know, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I want to back up a little bit, though, and
yep,
as you were talking about the sort of the collision of the two worlds, mm-hmm, it strikes me that I've read similar things like that back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then I think institutions have changed quite a lot.
Yep.
Was in the, very briefly, in the PhD program at U of T, yeah, and I wanted to write my thesis on Delaney. And the best thing to do was come up with an advisor who did some genre fiction, but not science fiction. So he did detective fiction, and that was like the only genre course they offered to the entire university at the time. Yeah. And so there was nobody taking science fiction seriously academically at U of T at the time, right?
Like, which is true. And when would that have been?
1984.
That's interesting because, I mean, it's around, isn't it, in the 80s or late 80s or around that time when Frederick Jameson is going on about Neuromancer is the best thing since, you know, sliced bread, and cyberpunk is, you know, the apotheosis of postmodern literature.
It's just starting to get there, though. I mean, and you know, just, I mean, given how monolithic, you know, yeah, our institutions tend to be, they move slowly, you know.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. I think institutions have changed a lot. I mean, I know for me, I've had at least three TAs in the past couple of years who are doing science fiction stuff in their theses. And it's not their entire dissertations aren't strictly science fiction. I mean, one person's doing Neuromancer with postmodern lit, you know,
yep.
All that kind of stuff. So I think things have changed in that way. But I mean, and that for me actually raises, I think one of the really rewarding things for me teaching this stuff has been as a teacher of English lit, in that I'm teaching fantasy and science fiction. I love this stuff as a fan, but I'm starting to really love it and appreciate it as craft, as art.
Yep.
And I mean, I was talking about Blindsight. I mean, Blindsight would be a wonderful novel to teach, you know, about narration and reliable narrators and unreliable narrators and you know, and perspective and point of view and focalization and all these things that are so crucial to narrative and narratology, and that, or, you know, Keyes' Flowers for Algernon, you know, and the artistry in that work, and that there's a lot of really fascinating, for me, formal experimentation that goes on in the history of science fiction, that I actually now start to see these texts as great ways to teach English literature, not just science fiction, you know, and one of my goals in some ways, hopefully as I go on, would be to maybe kind of sort of break down some of these barriers, and for instance, like, why not teach Lord of the Rings as a modernist novel? Or, you know, something like that, you know, and or, you know, teach some of this stuff in, like, you do Left Hand of Darkness in a postmodern novel course, you know, that kind of stuff. And because I start to see that there's as much literary craft and value in a lot of these works as the kind of more mainstream things that we tend to sort of teach in, you know, a modernist course or postmodernist course and that kind of stuff. I think it was, I don't know if you guys saw it, Kim Stanley Robinson back in the fall. Had this article, I think it was in the New Scientist, about how the Booker Prize in England is really failing because the best novelists in England right now are the science fiction writers. Hmm. You know, and the Booker Prize tends to really only like historical novels.
Yeah, yeah.
And the same thing happened in Canada with the Giller and the Governors General, that it's basically historical novels that tend to win these prizes. And he was making an argument that the best writing being done in Britain right now is the science fiction stuff.
It's ironic if we create, you know, if we started by legitimizing it by creating genre courses, and then, you know, and genre, you know, almost like genre contests by definition, and then, you know, have to again break them out of those things one more time to sort of further the step, you know, that you have to kind of take the next stage in getting them out there and actually being able to do other stuff within those fields. That's interesting.
In the interest of breaking down the barriers further, perhaps you should.
That was my next thing. Yeah. So
I'm curious why you
questions, comments. Yeah. Or,
what's postmodern?
What's
a postmodern science fiction book as opposed to a modernist science fiction book? Is there a difference? Is there a
Is
one more centered? Or?
I'll take a stab. A postmodern book would, I think, have two things that would be different. I think one, it would be more decentered. It would be more chaotic in its premise. Two, it would be more aware that it was those things. Okay? So a lot of, you know, sort of commentary on itself is something which a lot of postmodern and postmodern genre work would be able to do. The guy who's been doing this actually for years before we called it that, I think, is Terry Pratchett. But Terry Pratchett doesn't get called that way because we think of him as sort of lighthearted and everything else. And I think he's much, much more. There's much, much more going on in Pratchett's work than that. I think Pratchett is a classic example of a postmodern genre novelist. He's writing something which is commenting repeatedly on the genre, doing so with hitting the sweet spot of, with the heart, let's say, that some of the romantic novels had, the sort of sense that he loves writing in this field, but then also with the sort of satiric, you know, tinge that postmodernism brings to it, which is to say, you know, but on the other hand, come on, like, let's look at, you know, these problems that exist within this trope and this concept and this, you know, cliche and this, you know, this sort of typical, this trope, right? And so I think that that would be the way that I would describe it. It would be something that is commenting on itself, that is more chaotic theoretically, and that is commenting on its chaos or lack thereof in the process of doing it.
I mean, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, another perfect example. Sure.
Yeah. Sure. Well, for instance, like, one reason I would say, Lord of the Rings is a modernist novel is If you think in sort of the way in which we tend to historicize sort of the periods of English literature, you think of modernism as, you know, let's say, they tend to peg it, you know, kind of sort of World War I up to about, say, maybe the mid-late 40s, maybe into the early 50s. Mm-hmm. And if you think of the context in which Tolkien was writing Lord of the Rings, you know, kind of sort of mid-40s, I think, sort of early mid-40s and continuing on and so on and that. Much of the social historical context for that novel is World War II, as much as Tolkien likes to say, no, it's not an allegory.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is.
But there are I think there are also various formal concerns and political concerns and sociocultural concerns and so on that, like for me, the very darkness of Lord of the Rings is very much a kind of modernist T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland mm-hmm. kind of darkness, and no one really talks about Lord of the Rings as a modernist novel. You know, and I think it's interesting to probe some of those
sure.
boundaries and distinctions. But yeah, I think the way Greg has sort of characterized a postmodernist novel. I mean, I mentioned Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness. I mean, the opening couple of paragraphs, you know, Genley, you know, says, "Well, this is a report, but I'm going to give it to you in the form of a story, and." Facts are sensitive. You choose the facts that you feel, you know, work best. And yeah, it, you know, it's my story, but there are many different voices, but it's all one story.
Yep.
And you can't get, in a sense, kind of much more postmodernist than that. And recognizing that a story is comprised of a host of various perspectives.
Yeah.
And the very structure of Left Hand of Darkness does that, because Genley's report includes, you know, Githenian legends, and then he has a report from a previous person who came there and writes about Githenian sexuality, and then he has excerpts from Estrad's journal and that kind of stuff, so the very form of the novel is a variety of voices.
There are aspects of that in Peter Beagle's work, too.
Yeah,
Peter Beagle's
yeah.
The Last Unicorn
yep.
is exactly
yeah.
that kind
Definitely.
Of thing,
yeah.
which plays, you know, which plays with its own conventions, you know, as it's doing it, and which, in a way, has sort of implicit multiple voices, although obviously there's one narrative voice there, but there are implicit multiple voices in terms of to whom the story matters, right, at particular points in the novel, whether yeah. it's the unicorn or Prince Lear or Haggard or something like that. I just got done teaching him, which is why I was on
yeah,
online.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's another example of something like that. Interesting thing about Le Guin, by the way, is that Le Guin, I think really in A Wizard of Earthsea, writes more or less a modernist feeling novel,
mm, yeah.
and then in The Left Hand of Darkness writes more or less a postmodernist novel.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that she kind of, you know, straddles both
yeah.
time periods there.
Are any of you teachers?
I'm a teacher, but not of science fiction.
No.
I teach French.
Yeah.
But I'm starting my PhD at UB in the fall mm-hmm. in French, and I'd like to work with science fiction.
Oh,
yeah.
cool.
Or do you read a lot of like French science fiction?
Mm-hmm. Not enough.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Have a good evening.
I'm not a teacher. No. How did you have any particular reaction to, as Gregory called it, Neil Asher's screed?
Sorry.
I agree.
Yeah.
Do you have any, did you have a sense that there was this kind of sort of tension or divide or...
See, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Nobody buys this.
I found that I'm trying to justify the legitimacy of studying science fiction to
your students,
and I'm not
oh,
sure
really?
I have to. But I.
Yeah.
But I.
Oh, you do it with that. They don't bring this to you. You sort of feel like you have to before
yeah,
they ask.
Yeah, I start around the turn of the century, and you're right into pulp fiction, and you know the term pulp already. And
right.
then you have to say,
yeah.
well,
right.
this is why this came about. And then they read stories, and because they're so, I mean, that gap of, you know, now I guess it's close to 100 years, they can't connect to those stories. I have to provide a context for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they just think they're poorly written stories, which some of them are.
Yeah.
Some of them are. I mean, they have great ideas, but they're
yeah.
poorly written. They have poorly drawn characters and bad dialogue.
Yeah.
But they're very cool stories. So I have to explain to them why they're cool.
Yeah.
And why they're groundbreaking, why they're interesting. And so, yeah, I'm not sure what my point is.
Well, no, it's interesting that, I mean, what I was thinking of was it's interesting that you think that you're sort of having to explain the kind of legitimacy
myself.
Of the direction
yeah.
of how
yeah.
science fiction has developed over time in fantasy. I think we got really lucky in that a lot of very good a lot of very, very good creative works in fantasy and science fiction have been done recently in film, despite what I said before, but a lot of my own books that I teach for some reason having lousy movies. But, you know, Lord of the Rings were exceptionally well done and took it seriously. And I mentioned the superhero movies before that took things seriously.
Excuse me. Did anyone here find a cell phone?
No.
You
know? No, I'm sorry.
You should call it.
In fact,
she has the phone to call it.
I tried that.
Yeah. Sorry. But anyway, so, I mean, they you know, the fact that they took it seriously means that my students, anyway, have much less problem taking it seriously. You know, they saw a very good Star Trek movie, so it doesn't shock them then that, you know, I teach them courses and, you know, we have a class where I talk about Star Trek and the impact of Star Trek and show them an episode from the original series, and they, you know, and they find it very interesting and different, but very interesting. And I teach, and I show them City on the Edge of Forever, so I give them what I think is the best, you know, the best episode from that series. And to give them a sense of, you know, that maybe that historical feel to it. And I don't find that, I really have no one who sort of questions why we're even studying this at that point, thanks to the work that's been done, paradoxically, I can't believe I'm saying it, by Hollywood, that has given, and by more popular medias, that's given them this sense that, okay, I think that other people take this seriously, apparently, so now I get to study it and learn more about it. So.
The best thing is The Simpsons. If there's, you know, there are allusions to It's a Good Life and Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. And I Have No Mouth, But I'm a Scream. There's one in there, too.
And if you could point those out, then suddenly it legitimizes the original story in their eyes.
Sure.
Think, oh, well, there must be something of value.
Family Guy, same thing. They have the same kind of reference to it. But, and Futurama, too.
Yes,
which is,
very
you
much
know,
so,
But in that respect, I mean, science fiction and fantasy, I guess, have never been more mainstream than they are now.
Right.
Like film, TV, video games.
Right.
They've never been more mainstream than they are now. But and it's, Adam Roberts, a science fiction author and British academic, has argued in a recent book that, in fact, since about the 80s, the dominant mode of science fiction has been visual. Graphic novels, films, TV, video games, and that literary science fiction has declined.
Interesting.
Yet what we teach is sort of the literary side of things. And I think often I'll start a course with I'll get students to kind of talk to each other. Say, well, what's your favorite science fiction film ever? You know, and they'll like chat for 5 minutes and so on. And then I'll say, why do you think we started with that? You know, and eventually one of them gets, oh well, that's because, you know, we've all had some kind of experience of science fiction,
yep. Right?
And it gives us a starting point to say, well, what is science fiction, and what do we identify as science fiction, and then from there we can get into sort of the more sort of critical, theoretical, nitty-gritty stuff with literature. But I think there is now a point where they've all had some kind of experience of or exposure to science fiction, whether they call it science fiction or fantasy or not.
Yeah, I find myself making references to fantasy and science fiction in non-genre classes. At least 3 times every semester I'm going to, in a regular literature class that I teach, a literature survey, I'll mention The Matrix. Because of some aspect of The Matrix, they've all seen it, they all think it's cool, they all, you know, and there are things which sort of are good reference points for things that I'm teaching in that course. So.
Maybe we should teach novelizations.
Yeah. Oh, but it's so in the looking glass then. See, we just said we don't want a navel gaze now.
Cameron's going to do a novel of Avatars.
I'll bet he is. I bet it'll be all 3D, too. Straight up.
The novel would. Yeah. You guys have any questions for us?
Do you find that the genre is diluted now because of the proliferation of mainstream science fiction, that the books, I think you mentioned the books are not as... not as many books being published?
Yeah, well, actually, I think even publishing figures for the last several years actually show a decline in science fiction and an increase in fantasy.
And an increase in fantasy, that's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. What was? How did you word it again?
No, I was just interested if you thought that science fiction, what is being published, if it's getting better, you know, from the golden age, or if it's getting worse because of so much popular culture and trying to write books that sort of could be sold as screenplays. I mean, is there an influence there by the Hollywood mainstream?
It's interesting.
Or is it all just...
I mean, I guess from my perspective and the stuff that I'm reading and the stuff I'm trying to catch up on to keep the course kind of fresh,
yeah.
I would say, from my perspective, I would say the literary part of the genre has perhaps never been stronger. There is some really, really great stuff being out there. Like great writing, original, very imaginative, very challenging stuff. At least from what I've been reading, and you know, stuff that could be taught in a whole bunch of different ways and a whole bunch of different kinds of courses. I mean, you could do an entire course on American post-apocalypse literature, and there would be some incredible stuff from The Road that you mentioned in the previous panel. To Octavia Butler, to some really, really amazing stuff. So I think the literary part of things has, for my, is very strong. But maybe there's been a kind of reversion in the sense that the TV, video games, and films have become so mainstream and so popular that the literary stuff is more of a niche again in some ways.
I don't think it's gotten worse, because I think that the things which are sort of demonstrably pop culture stuff almost have become their own deal. Like Twilight is its own thing, and there are people, and this certainly happened with Harry Potter. There's absolutely crossover from people who read Harry Potter into other things. It's absolutely true, and it's why I think J.K. Rowling should make as much money as she makes. This is a person who is able to get some, kids standing in line at midnight in front of stores like they would do for video games and console systems, and they were doing it for books. And to my mind, someone who could do something that we have been unable to do for 40 years deserves all the credit that she gets. So that, I think, I would put more into that. There's more sort of crossover there. Twilight and books like that, which are very much more pop culture and not really well written, in my view, that kind of stuff is, I think, almost its own sort of side issue, and I don't think that it really runs the risk of diluting the genre, because I think everyone in the genre has this sort of visceral, like, oh my god, I hate that, I mean, people who write vampires hate the fact that they sparkle, people who don't write vampires just sort of hate that. The whole thing is just like, it's absurd. You'd have a hard time finding someone who's really sort of established in the genre who would admit to liking it, other than in some sort of broad, well, if some people like it, so I guess it must be okay, which is, damning with the faintest of praise, right? So I don't think it dilutes the genre, but I think that, again, it depends. I think this is an opportunity for us, is what I would say.
It could create misconceptions about the genre.
Yes, I think we have the opportunity now to say, that's great that you're really into this, and that's really interesting, and let me show you all these other really interesting things, because I totally agree with Mike that there's a lot of very, very good stuff out there that's being done. Extremely good, both in science fiction and in fantasy, that is unusual and striking. I mentioned in the last panel Catherine Valenti's Palom's Pest, which just came out. I mentioned Greer Gilman's a little bit older, but there's some sort of reignited interest in her. There's a lot of really fascinating stuff happening there. So this is an opportunity to take the excitement and the enthusiasm with which our students, that they're bringing to us, and say, this is great. Let me show you all these other cool things that's out there. All these new worlds, right, that you can find, that you can actually do something with. And so I think the question is, will we do that? Or will we sort of, as they arrive, kind of do the, no, that's ridiculous, and, no, and you must, again, go back to that whole marble statue thing that academics sometimes fall into the rut of doing. If we do that, this is not going to last. This wave will not last, at least as far as academics are concerned, I think. But if we can sort of channel it the right way, I think we could put an incredible synergy between what the Academy does and what our students and what popular culture generally is doing about science fiction and fantasy. So it could be the opposite of diluting. It could help the genre. And I'm interested in this also because I write in it as well as teach it. So from my point of view, for both jobs, it would be good for that to be able to happen. So whether that will happen or not, who knows? But I think we have a real opportunity right this second to be able to do that sort of thing. I don't know what you guys think, but that's...
I think, in a way, colleges and universities represent, I think, an incredible market for the genre.
Yep.
I mean, if I've got a course of consecutively 180, 220 students...
Yeah, those numbers are crazy. It's amazing.
I
was so happy to 23.
I hear you say 23, and I'm
220.
Like,
you bastard! Oh, my God.
But I think, there's an incredible market there in the sense that, you know, if I'm assigning various books, I mean, that's good for the publisher, it's good for the author, and it exposes students to different things. And so I think, and, you know, you're doing Ender's Game constantly, so, I mean, that it can keep some of these books,
I agree,
you know, in print, and maybe particularly some of the older stuff
yep.
that goes out of print, but then gets kind of revalued and re-legitimized,
yep.
perhaps, in an academic context.
I agree, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I was trying to find Bester's The Star is My Destination, that's out of print, and I want to read that to see if I might want to teach it
yeah,
someday,
yeah, yeah.
you know, and it's out of print now,
yeah.
so... that the academic market could be a great kind of market in that respect. And I used to kind of really keep this wave going and,
yep.
and really strengthen, I guess, the exposure of the genre.
The only thing that I can add, because I agree with pretty much everything you said, is I wonder about how we label things as genre and non-genre.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often wondered about the, you know, the rise of... online bookstores where they can categorize a book, put a book in several different categories,
mm-hmm.
Whereas a brick-and-mortar bookstore
yep.
has to take Margaret out and put her in one section,
yep.
and has to take, you know...
Audrey Diffenegger.
Yeah, it's rare that... And so you have Ian Banks and Ian M. Banks, right?
Yeah.
Because he wants to be in two different sections.
Right. Or Octavia Butler ending up somehow in African-American studies instead of ending up, you know, because... Why? Because she's black? Or because when she's writing very clearly genre fiction. You see what I mean? I mean, so this sense that, and that's something that happens in brick and mortar, which doesn't, blessedly, happen as much at online bookstores. So in that sense, I never thought of that, but in that sense, online bookstores may be a good thing in that regard, because it will help blur these, you know, these lines. Maybe.
I'm going to, tomorrow I'm actually going to go to Amazon and see if Margaret Atwood comes up in science fiction.
Huh.
I don't think she
you know what though, but she spent her whole career claiming that's not what she writes, which I think
right.
is funny. That's sort of someone who's stuck back in the this mindset, yeah. you know, that no, I can't let anyone think that. I mean, come on.
What about the road? Where would they put that?
Of course.
So,
of course, yeah.
I actually begin my course with Margaret Atwood.
Ah, see.
With her.
You should send her a letter and let her know.
Yeah. Well, just her recent comments about the Year of the Flood, and then Ursula Le Guin's review of Year of the Flood. And Le Guin, Atwood saying, I don't write science fiction. Science fiction is about stories that take space, that take place far, far away in space and in other galaxies.
Yes.
And Le Guin begins her review of The Year of Flood by saying, Margaret Atwood says it's science fiction, so I can't talk about it as science fiction. So an entire discourse is now cut off that would allow me to really value this.
I haven't read that. Well, good for Le Guin. I mean, really.
It's in The Guardian, I think. It's online.
You think Atwood would feel that she was established enough that even if this supposed, you know, stigma, which I don't think exists anymore at anywhere near the same degree, you'd think that she could get over it now?
Yeah. She says she would expect it.
Well, yes.
Well, guys, thanks for a really great discussion.
Thanks for proposing it, Mike.
Yeah, yeah. This is
and thank you, guys.
Thanks for coming, guys. Late on a Friday night. Thanks a lot, guys.